This is a big book study, so I'm assuming that we're going to talk about the big book and read a little bit from it. If this is your first introduction or your first time through the steps...
I'll try to ask a question. How many of you guys, this is the first time?
Wow.
Okay.
I rode the wave about 23 years ago.
So maybe come down there. Who here has completed their AMETS?
Completed.
Who here has written inventory all four inventories, including sex ideal? At least once. Okay, this gives me a good idea. Okay. Because sometimes, and I'm not saying you all do this, I have been known to be a big book study whore. What that kind of means is I come here and I steal stuff from people who sound really good and then I act like I actually did it. Yeah, research is about it, right? Yeah, but I don't actually do the work. I just quote Don and, you know, Mark and Joe and, you know, like, and just pass it off. But one of the things that I was taught, which is don't let anybody read your big book for you. And what that means is we're going to talk about stuff. I'm going to talk about different aspects of this book. We're going to hit some highlights of this book. But the real work happens when you're sitting across from another alcoholic, reading line by line, paragraph by paragraph. This is not a substitute for sponsorship. In fact, if you read this book, which eventually I did do, it consistently tells us that solitary self-appraisal is seldom sufficient. It tells us in the ninth step that we need to use guidance and sponsorship. You know, throughout this book, it tells us, and it is assuming that we are using each other for peer support. So when we talk, or when I talk about, or when I, you know, go through this, I'm not going through it nuts and bolts, sentence by sentence, word by word, because you'll be bored to tears, and there's not enough time to do that effectively. So, and honestly, I would be depriving you of the experience of being sponsored. And sponsorship is one of the most important relationships you're going to have. And for me, the sponsorship was a model of my relationship with God. Because when I got here, you know, I was in open warfare with God. I blamed him for a lot of things that happened in my life. I kind of glossed over, and the flight deck is the psych ward. The fact that I had been institutionalized many, many times and met criteria to be institutionalized many, many times. Because I did die by my own hand and tried quite a bit. I came here very, very broken. With a lot of problems, a lot of issues, and a lot of yeah buts, and if you only knew. And this book cuts through that. We're here to deal with alcoholism. The other stuff does resolve itself, or at least empowers us to go to where this stuff gets resolved. But sponsorship is where that stuff, where that rubber meets the road. And we can read this stuff and we can talk about it, but intellectually understanding something and having an experience with it are two very different things. And I'll give you an example. So, not to toot my own horn, but like, I'm like weird, crazy smart. Like, I'm completely incapable of functioning as a human being in many, many ways, such as I cannot change a tire. I mean, technically I know how, but somehow I managed to not be able to do it. That's why I love AAA. I can't parallel park. I lose my keys all the time. Somewhere in the airport today, I dumped an entire bottle of water in my purse. I don't know how to do that. The fact that I can actually, you know, get out of the house and get to work and do these sorts of things is a gosh darn miracle. But I'm really smart book-wise. So at some point I got in my head, and there was this bright idea that if I went into the Navy, they would pay for grad school. Well, and I, of course, I wasn't going to go in, like, you know, like, enlisted, you know, because I'm awesome. So I applied to Navy OCS. And if you know what that is, that's Officer Candidate School. And in order to get into Navy OCS, you have to pass what's called the ASTB, which is a pilot's exam. And basically, it's nautical information and aeronautics, as well as math and crap like that, physics, you know, smart stuff, right? So, I studied for this exam. I have flashcards and study guides. I taught myself aerodynamics and aeronautics, and I have physics and nautical stuff. And I studied for about 6 weeks, and I got straight fives on my ASTB. Straight fives means I qualified for flight school. I can't parallel park my car. I can tell you how a plane flies. I had no practical experience with that at all. Mind you, I am still waitlisted for Navy OCS, so if World War III happens, the carrier is going to be on an aircraft carrier somewhere in the Indian Ocean or something. But I did get a discount for grad school. But I'm kind of talking and saying, like, look, you know, like, I could technically tell you how a plane flies, but I didn't fly my ass here. I had absolutely nothing to do with it except for walking up and saying, here's my tickets, ma'am. You know? So when we're talking about the step process and we're saying, and I'm telling you that on a level of we're talking about this and we can intellectually understand it, experientially understanding it are two very different things. What I would like us to do is to be able to take what we're talking about intellectually and apply it experientially. And that's something that has to happen in the context of sponsorship, or at least in the context of one alcoholic helping another. Because I can pervert all kinds of things and justify it by spiritual stuff. You know, I researched religions in which it was perfectly acceptable to have lots of fun with lots of different people. And I felt that because it was written in a spiritual book, that should be my ideal. I was confused by that notion by my sponsor. So that's where I say that sometimes we can, you know, we can take information and we can twist it. So this is where guidance, this is where sitting with another alcoholic, this is where accountability and allowing God to work through other people and humility kind of comes in. So if there's something that we're talking about that you're not understanding, stop me. Say, I don't get that. What does that mean? Can you elaborate? If there's something that you need, there's something you're not right, you don't want to talk about in here, pull me aside. I have gone to conferences where people have described doing very, very gross things with bananas. Like, I gotta tell you something. This is something I didn't have in my fist up. I'm like, oh no. There's nothing I haven't heard. There's nothing we haven't heard. With that being said, if there's something that you're not comfortable with bringing up here, there's all these other people here. Grab somebody. Ask a question. Talk about it. Get some air on it, as my sponsor likes to tell me. Put some air on that. Because when it's intellectual, the experience of sharing it is where the real healing comes. So sponsorship is necessary. One alcoholic with another is necessary. This is not a substitute for that. This is just an opportunity for us to kind of bring together our combined experience and go deeper. But this is not, this is absolutely 100% not a substitute for sponsorship. Please don't make it be so. Because I don't know how many times I have gone to a conference where somebody listened to a tape that I made 10 years ago and said, in 2003, you said, yada, yada, yada. And I'm thinking, what? I don't remember saying that. And then I'm thinking, you know, like, and I'm thinking, like, really? You really, where's your sponsor on this? Why didn't ask her? I'm like, well, why are you asking me? This is between you, God, and your sponsor, man. If you take one of us or one of us speakers or one of these people and you make our word law and then you create an idea around it, you're depriving yourself of a heck of a lot of freedom. You know, because sometimes even us speakers can be jackasses. So with that being said, you know, this is about us sharing our experience, but don't take, if there's something here where we say, that dog don't hunt, if something I say contradicts what this book says, or something I say doesn't hit you in the gut in the right place and it feels like that's not good for me, talk to someone about it. Ask questions. Don't just take that and squirrel it away like a squirrel with a nut and hide it, because that's going to be that thing that's going to keep coming back at you. And what we want to do is get free, not create more prisons for ourselves. So, first thing first is the first step, right? So what is the first step? What is the real idea behind it, right? When we have a lot of concept about what it means, we use words like powerless, unmanageability, right? We read it off the wall all the time, and of course I was always taught that, you know, working the steps off the wall means I have an off-the-wall program. It says we, as in us, right? The collective we. Not I. I came here and I am now a we. I am powerless, we are not. Together as a collective, we are not powerless over alcohol. As an individual, I am. And that's something that a lot of times we don't understand. And when I'm talking about the we are not powerless, I mean the fellowship of the Spirit, not the sick and suffering alcoholic who has not been restored to sanity. And it says, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, dash, that our lives have become unmanageable. I'd like to read that off, right out of how it works, because there's a lot to that sentence, and there's a lot to this step. And I think a lot of times people come to me and they say, hey, Carrie, sponsor me. I'm like, well, where are you in the steps? I'm on step 4. I ask a few questions, and it turns out they're on step 0. Yeah. Because there's a lot of ways to look at this step. I mean, I think a lot of us kind of knew that we were alcoholic, but didn't know what it meant to be an alcoholic. And I think that because we're all different people and we all have different experiences, that often we look at the things that define us and separate us rather than the things that bond us. And when we have this construction metaphor throughout this book, right? Now, by virtue of growing up, you know, in the shadow of New York City and reading this book and reading Bill's construction metaphor, when he talks about making mortar without sand, he talks about keystones and cornerstones and are my, you know, my stones properly in place and all of these things, right? And I realized that he probably was watching them build, you know, the beautiful skyscrapers that are part of the New York skyline that I take for granted, but he was watching them being built from the ground up. You know, so he's writing this book talking about using a construction metaphor because that's what he's seeing outside in his life, in his apartment in Brooklyn, and, you know, in Newark, you know. And I think to myself, you know, he uses a term, and he says that we have a common peril meaning alcoholism, a common solution meaning the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, so when I say that we were powerless, what I mean is that me, as an alcoholic, have lacked power over my alcoholism. We, coming together with common peril, common solution, can gain access to a power greater than ourselves that can enable us to be placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. That we are restored to sanity in regards to alcohol. We're recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. That's a wonderful proposition, and it is absolutely true. But there are things that we have to do. So I think that a lot of times people think that they, and I thought, I worked the first step and I was drinking. But the truth is that the real, what this step really means, I think, becomes deeper and deeper for me all the time. Because I understood it on one level, meaning Carrie can't drink, booze is bad, Carrie needs to do some stuff. And then understanding on another level that my life has become unmanageable because I'm managing it. Okay. You know, that's a pretty simple thing. You have an idiot running your life, you're going to have a life that's run by an idiot.
Okay. But what does that mean? You know, how do we live in this world? Not managing our lives, but still live in this world. That's a huge, huge conundrum to be in, right? That's a paradox. Because if you think about it, I'm saying that my life is unmanageable, that I need to live by spiritual principles and there are things that I need to do. I do this stuff. The problem that I have with alcohol disappears. Yet, I still make decisions every day. I put my shoes on, I show up, I go to work, I pay bills, right? I take care of my children. I live in the world, yet I live in a world in which I don't manage my life. Sometimes. And sometimes I do, and I get some pretty horrendous consequences. So there's a lot to this stuff. It's not just a, okay, you know, I love it when people say, you know, it's like what, I came to believe, right? I don't know, that sounds to me like a porn movie, but that's a... Sorry, that's the Jersey in me. Trying! No. So. Or it says, I can, he can, I think I'll let him. But there's a lot to that. Because you know what? I'll let God with my alcoholism, but I ain't giving him my bank account. I'll let God with my bank account because I feel like God's a, you know, pretty much an ATM, but I ain't giving him my children. I let God with my children, but I ain't giving them my job. Now, so when I was talking about agnosticism, this is what I'm talking about. Areas of my life in which I still feel as if I have power. So when we're talking about this first step, and I think we're going to talk about it on multiple levels, this is what I'm talking about. So it's not just an off the wall, okay, check the box. I cannot drink successfully. And I think about drinking, and my thoughts about drinking suck. Check. No. My thoughts about Carrie suck. My thoughts about you suck. What I think I know about you and me usually gets me in some deep trouble. And that there's some spiritual principles that I need to be applying to all areas of my life that I really struggle with. And that when I say that I fall asleep dreaming I'm awake, what I'm doing is I'm falling asleep to the fact that when I manage certain areas of my life, they become very, very unmanageable. And I come to believe that there's only certain things that God will take care of and the rest of it is my job. And that's where I get stuck on the dash. Meaning that I'll give God my alcohol problem, but I ain't giving him anything else. Or if I do, I make very subtle demands on God. So when we're looking at this step, we're really looking at it in the multifaceted way. From the straightforward way, what it means is I have a physical craving. In the doctor's opinion, and I love Dr. Silkworth. Thank God for Dr. Silkworth. You know, I was talking to Mike on the way here, and I was saying that, you know, we were talking about my profession and a little bit about how you know, what I do for a living and what I do in Alcoholics Anonymous are two very different things. And I say that I really try very hard to leave what I do at the door. But there are times when I get so excited because I realize that Dr. Silkworth knew. And I take classes and trainings and I do all of this stuff about neurobiology. And I've had, you know, trust me, really boring crap that you don't really want to know at all. But what makes me really excited about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is that I can remember sitting in a classroom as getting my undergraduate degree, and I can remember sitting in grad school listening to a professor explain what Alcoholics Anonymous taught me and telling me the science behind it, saying, well, you know, this is what we know now. And I'm thinking, I've known that. I said, I have a book that was published in 1939 that said the exact same thing that you're saying right now. Y'all think you invented it? Dr. Silkworth saw something in alcoholics. He didn't know what it was. He didn't have the technology at the time to understand it, but he knew something. He said we had an allergy, an abnormal reaction to alcohol. You know, I talked to you about my sister. I said my sister abuses alcohol because she doesn't drink it properly. She has nightcaps and stuff like that. She tells me that when she drinks, she gets warm and fuzzy. Sleepy, and that it relaxes her. Alcohol has a very opposite effect on me. For one, I don't feel the first one nor the second, and maybe probably not the third. I mean, quite frankly, the fact is that I'm not counting, and I'm drinking at a large, copious jugs of alcohol. I mean, like, what a normal person would consider a serving of, did you know, it's like, I never knew this, like, fingers, like, one finger, two finger, that was a serving. I didn't get that. I like, what do you say, I have a finger of gin? I figured it was, like, I didn't understand it on the side. I was, like, I mean, quite frankly, I drank from the bottle with a paper bag on it. So, like, I didn't get that. But, I mean, like, normal people, shot glasses, you know, they weren't to play quarters with. Like, people use it and say, measure that out. That's what they have. And I would think, the hell is wrong with you? You know, so people, you know, have very limited, their ideas or quantities in alcohol are very different than my own. And I mean, very different than my own. Because they're having a different experience than I'm having. And that's something, that is what Dr. Silkworth understood. Now, I'm not here to explain to you all of the stuff that I've learned in school that justifies this. What I'm here to say is that my experience tells me this is true. My experience tells me that I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. Now, I love this, and if you go to the doctor's opinion, I'm using the 4th edition. I know some people are partial to 3rd. I'm gonna, like I said, I'm not gonna page you to death, but there's a couple things I really want to hit on. And the very, very beginning of the doctor's opinion, on XXV, for those in the 4th edition, and 3rd edition, I don't know because I was too lazy to write down the page numbers, to be honest with you. It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in a medical estimate and the plan of recovery described in this book. And what's salient about this statement is that there's a plan of recovery. I thought that I was told, take what you want and leave the rest. I was told that I could pick and choose the steps that I would work. Because I can take what I want and leave the rest. I will take the first step. I will take the second step. I am not doing the 3rd step. I'm certainly not doing the 4th step. I'll make amends to the people that I feel that need to be made amends to. And I'll do prayer and meditation when I feel like it. I mean, that's the program that I would work. And that's probably why I kept drinking and dying. I'm pretty sure that's why I kept drinking and dying. literally. But it says that there's a plan of recovery described in this book. Meaning that we're going to have clear cut directions, that there are things that we're going to do. That this is not an arbitrary thing, that this is about experience. So Dr. Silkworth shares his opinion. But what he shares is an opinion that is now, today, we know grounded in fact. That the alcoholic has an abnormal reaction, that there's something physiologically going on with us that is different than the average person. And what he says is, and I love that he says this, that there's a plan of recovery. That, like anything else, I like the word recipe. I think it works better because, and this is my thing, is like, we use the analogy of baking a cake, right? And I say that, like, if I take away the shortening or I take away the eggs, I don't really have a cake, do I? Now, I could put chocolate chips and pistachios, I could put cocoa in it, coconut. I could add things to my cake. But if I take away the fundamental ingredients, I don't have a cake anymore. I have a hockey puck. So when we're talking about this plan of recovery, and I'm saying, you know, you can bring other things to the table, and this could be a part of your plan of recovery. But the plan of recovery that we're talking about in this book is the bare bones, nuts, and bolts of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we don't take away from this, because really what it is a very basic plan. He goes on to talk about his experience with Bill, and he says, you know, this guy's been in my hospital a bunch of times. He's been in my hospital and he keeps drinking, right? And then he comes into the hospital and he says, you know, as part of my rehabilitation, I need to tell other people about how I've gotten sober. That's part of the plan, is carrying a message. I remember being in my home group, and I was a member of the Spiritual Awakenings group in Bernardsville, New Jersey. And I am eternally grateful to the men who founded that meeting. because we had the, well, we were right outside of New York, so anybody who came to Fox, Fellowship of the Spirit, came to my home group, and we got them. And we would torture them with questions because we were on fire, big book people. We had questions. I have questions from people back east to ask you all. So, you know, like, we are on fire, big book people. So, like, you know, if some poor little guy from Colorado or Texas or California happened to end up in Burnsville, New Jersey, he had about 15, 20 rabid big book, frothing at the mouth, crazy people asking them millions of questions about, well, if you do this, and what about this amends, and what if you do that, what if you spin on your head, what if you wrote inventory on this, and what if it's okay, and they were beautiful human beings who tolerated us, and were, I think we touched them. I think that, like, our fire and our desire and our thirst for knowledge, information, and experience, I think really tickled them. So I'm sitting, you know, in this home group, I have these, you know, these big book demigods at the time for me, you know, coming in and sitting down and just sharing in a meeting with us. And it was an incredible experience. And I used to say to them, my favorite question was, how do you know you have a spiritual experience? And they would laugh at me, every damn one of them. I used to get so pissed off. I'm like, you know, everybody worships the ground you walk on. You can't tell me how to get a spiritual experience? What's wrong with you? You know, and mind you, it's very clear, it's right in this book, but I kept thinking, like, well, how am I going to know I have it? Is there a diagnosis? We can diagnose spirituality, it's called the bedevilments, right? We can diagnose alcoholic thinking. We have a diagnosis, we have tests to see if you're an alcoholic. You can go up to the bar, you know, drink, try some controlled drinking, stop drinking for a year. We have tests for everything except for the spiritual experience, right? No, it's in here, but I didn't read my book. You know, like, I was reading my book, if you get my drift. And I wanted them to give me, like, this thing. I wanted them to, you know, kind of bless me, be like, you are spiritually awake. God bless you, child, go forth and prosper. Instead, they would laugh at me. And today I understand why. I absolutely understand why. Because the spiritual awakening happens when you put the experience that you've had with a higher power and you bring it out to God's children. It happens between you and me. I can't keep it for myself. It's not something I do in a closet. It's not something I do in my private space with my inventory that I write, but nobody can watch. Nobody can see it. And I hide it in the trunk of my car because God forbid you read my... My husband's resentment inventory was sitting at the kitchen table about a year ago, and my name was at the top of the column. Like, literally, there's his note. He said, Carrie, A, B, C, D, 11, you know, X, Y, and Z. I look at it, close it, walk away. Not my business. Those are his resentments with me. You know, one, if he looked at the resentments I had with him or the inventory wrote of him, he'd probably divorce me. And two, that's his second column. That's none of my business. But at the time, I didn't realize that part of this spiritual experience that I'm developing, and a good portion of it, is about carrying this in the interaction between me and God's children. So I do this step experience. I have this experience with the fourth step. I have this fifth step. I have this 6 and 7, 8 and 9. I live in 10, 11, and it's in 12. And it's not in the dotting the I's and crossing the T's. It's in the sitting with this book in my kitchen table with another alcoholic, watching God do for them what they could not do for themselves, and realizing that that's happening within me. You being my spiritual mirror. And Dr. Silkworth tells us that. He says as part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, and pressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. That's part of our rehabilitation. It is not the crowning glory of our rehabilitation. It is not a graduation that we carry this message. It is how we get knitted back together. It happens in that process. You know, if you wait to carry this message until you have all the answers, you're going to be drunk. So, and I love that Dr. Silkworth saw that. He knew that. That it was in carrying this message, having this experience, that rehabilitate, or that's clinical ease for have a spiritual experience. And if you look at the rest of this chapter, on the next page, he says, we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. I took exception to that, because I didn't have an abnormal mind. You know, I felt like everybody thought like me. Or you should. You know, because the way that I thought was right, and you were wrong. So if you didn't agree with me, you sucked. So my mind wasn't abnormal. You were just stupid. So when I read that, I got really mad. I was like, I don't have an abnormal mind. I had no problem with the abnormal body. I kind of got that, you know. But it goes on to say that it does not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life. I mean, I was. That we're in full flight of reality, absolutely. Or that we were outright mental defective. Yeah. These things were true to some extent, and in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, right? But we are sure that our bodies are sickened as well. Our belief that the picture of the alcoholic which leaves out the physical factor is incomplete. And there's a reason why Bill starts this book with the allergy. And here's the deal. This, regardless of what you drank or how, or when you started, or when you crossed that line, some of us crossed it, some of us were born over it, some of us were freeze-dried alcoholics, just add alcohol and poof, maniac. Some of us had that experience. Some of us didn't. But the thing that binds us is our common peril and common solution. The common peril meaning that I didn't just drink because I was maladjusted to life or outright mental defective, that there is something physically going on. So whether or not you sipped Chardonnay or you guzzled vodka, the way that you drank is irrelevant. It's the way that your body responded to it that matters. And Bill's smart because he knows we look for the exception. I'm always the exception. There's always a reason why this doesn't apply to me, because if you knew, and that's why he puts it right out in front. And he says, look, man, some of us are more messed up than others. Some are sicker than others. The bottom line is this, is we have an abnormal reaction. Our bodies are sickened as well. And as an alcoholic, I can understand that. As an alcoholic, I know what he's talking about. What he's saying is once I start drinking, I can't stop. And when I stop, I feel itchy inside. That's the way I describe it. We say irritable, restless, and discontent. I say I feel itchy inside me. I ain't right. So when we go to this and say that our theory, that the doctor's theory that we have an allergy interests us, to laymen, the opinion of a soundness may mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, and here's a big question, the consideration method, and here's the bottom line, is the consideration method of going through the steps is probably one of the best ways of reading this book, is turning every declarative statement into a question. A declarative statement says, we alcoholics, he, us, alcoholics of our type. When he makes a statement like that, what he's saying is this your experience? So we ask ourselves, as an alcoholic, does this explanation make sense? Absolutely. Absolutely makes sense. It makes sense as to why I can say to myself, I'm only going to have 2, but I have 10. It makes sense that once I start, there's something going on inside of me that I can't stop. It makes sense as to why I have to drink before I drink. Because I'm not feeling the second one. I'm feeling the second one on my 15th because my body is different. And here's the deal. And again, brilliant. Like I said, once you get past the grammar of this book, it is brilliant. Because on first blush, one, this was page 1, which is why I started with it. You know, I could go through the appendices, and I could go through the recovery rates and all that other stuff, and do all those bells and whistles, and talk about Bill's you know, trip to Akron. I could talk about Dr. Bob being planted under the table. I could talk about Henrietta Seiberling. I can give the whole history of Alcoholics Anonymous. Absolutely can't, but there are speakers who do way better than me. You know, so I wanted to start on page one because I thought, well, because that really was page one until we renumbered the book. There have been changes to the big book. The legend that there are no changes to the big book, that's actually bull crappies. They've changed the big book. And the worst, the most horrific, most terrible change was putting the doctor's opinion in the damn Roman numerals, because I'm an alcoholic and I go right to page one. I don't read appendixes. I don't read shit with the Roman numerals. I go right to page one and start highlighting stuff. And some of the most important information was on page one. It's not anymore. So as an alcoholic, you know, I missed a bunch of crap the first time I read this book. And it's a good, that's why we have sponsors. Because my sponsor said, oh, you started a Bill story. You realize that there's a doctor's opinion before that. Oh. You know, because my sponsor, when I first went through the book, when I first went through the steps, you know, I had to read the first 164 pages before I sat down to the table and started working the steps. I think it was a test to find out how much crap I was, you know, how much full of crap I was. I mean, I think that it was one of those times and where, like, I was such an angry, ornery little bastard that I think pretty much he was hoping I didn't read it so he didn't have to sponsor me. I'm pretty sure that was the case, you know, because I was angry and I was miserable and I was a know-it-all little shit. So he told me to go read that first 164 pages and call him when I was done, and I read it in one day. But I missed the doctor's opinion because I didn't read Roman numerals. You said 164. I started on page one. I had to go back and read the doctor's opinion. So I think that's one of the biggest tragedies, that we missed that. With that being said, Bill Smart, because he started with the craving. He started with something that I can't change. He started with something where I can't fix you or make you different in order for it to go away. Now the mental obsession, the spiritual malady, that's something that I can still externalize and say it's your fault. It's something I could still say, well, if my husband wasn't such a jerk and my family wasn't this and that wasn't this and this wasn't that and yada, 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 if I could fix that stuff, it'll go away. I can drink successfully. But he starts with the craving and the physical allergy for a reason. Because it starts with something I can't change about myself. I can't change the fact that I have green eyes. I mean, I can wear contacts, but I take them off when I have green eyes. I can't change the fact that I'm pale as, you know, that I glow in the dark. You know, I can tan, and and it'll go away, and I'll still glow in the dark 90% of the time. I can't change the color of my skin. I can't change my eyes. I can dye my hair, but it's going to keep growing back. So on some level, right, we recognize that there are physical things that we can't change or fix. So by starting with the craving, he started with that one thing that we have some level of acceptance with anyway. Brilliant man. Terrible writer. So the doctor's opinion goes on to explain that there's a need for a spiritual experience. He calls it a psychic change. He talks about psychology. And again, I'd love to go, I have hours and hours of information on the history of addiction, the history of addiction treatment, and what moral psychology is, but I'll give you kind of a quick idea of why Dr. Silkworth is so incredible. It is because originally, like most of the, up until this point, and up until the idea of the disease concept, which by the way was also coined by Dr. Silkworth. So not only did he find out what neurobiologists have just figured out about 10 years ago, but he also kind of codified this disease concept, meaning that alcoholism is a malady or a disease or some a constellation of symptoms, right? Now, he kind of proposed this throughout this book. Bill talks about it. He compares it to cancer. He goes on to talk about it and say, well, you know, is it possible that this isn't because you're a bad person, but because you have something going on with you? Right? This is what he puts forward. Prior to this, the belief was that alcoholics were morally corrupt. You ever hear the term eugenics? Do you know what eugenics is? For those of you who don't, eugenics was like basically genetic engineering before genetic engineering. It was a belief that traits, personality traits, were inherited. And so if you were an alcoholic, you were considered to be morally inferior, and therefore you were unacceptable to society, and you should be separated from good folk. Okay. Now, Hitler took it a little too far, but essentially his ideas were based on eugenics, which was actually an American ideal, actually perpetuating Princeton University. You guys know that? That Hitler didn't come up with that idea, we did. But one of the things that's very significant about it is they saw social ills, such as addiction, such as alcoholism, as being a genetic thing, and that people were genetically inferior. And one of the things that we actually did as a policy in our country was actually to sterilize people who were in institutions against their will and without their knowledge. And you know who was sterilized? People like us. That's exactly who was sterilized. It was, well, if you can't get rid of drugs, just don't let them breed. But that's honestly how our society viewed alcoholism. And then we get this little guy working at town's hospital who absolutely changed the world and changed the way that the world viewed alcoholism. Holy crap. Even the Washingtonians believed that alcoholism was a moral failing. This was the first guy who said, and it stuck. I'm sure people have said it. William James said it. Anybody who's read Varieties of Religious Experience, William James talks in great detail about how a spiritual experience can create a complete and total personality shift. So people have said it. But Dr. Soapers was the first person who said it, and something was done with it. And in a way that we have this recipe for recovery, meaning the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So he proposed that something more than moral psychology, meaning teaching bad people not to be bad anymore, was needed for an alcoholic to recover. You know, who here has seen the movie Quills? Anybody here seen the movie Quills? Okay, you guys haven't. Okay. Do you guys know who Bedlam is? Well, you have. you know Bedlam? You heard Bedlam? Okay, Bedlam is a hospital in London in which they put maniacs and dipsodics. You know what dipsodics are? Alcoholics. They used to lock us up. Anybody who's ever seen the movie Bram Stoker's Dracula? You guys seen that, right? Okay, so that was Bedlam, and that's what they did to us. They sprayed us with hot and cold water. They tied us up. They put us behind bars. We got wet brain. We did weird things. Maybe we ate some bugs. I'm not really sure. I mean, that's what the movie said. But the idea is that the solution to deal with alcoholics was to remove them from society and lock them up. And Dr. Silkworth said something very different. He said that alcoholics could be rehabilitated, that we can have a psychic change, that we could have a profound spirit rearrangement of our spiritual compass. And that by virtue of that, we would no longer do the crazy things that we do. And by virtue of that, we're sitting here and we're not locked up or in 4-point restraints or in straight jackets. We're not in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. They're not squirting us with hot and cold water and giving us belladonna till we poop ourselves. That's what they did to Bill. He talks about it in his story. Bill Wilson talks about getting the belladonna treatment and hydrotherapy. Hydrotherapy was squirting you with hot and cold water trying to shock your system so that you stop doing crazy things. Dr. Silkworth knew that there was a solution but didn't know how to get it. He understood that something more than moral psychology was necessary. He understood that we had a physical allergy. He understood that. And it was the Oxford group that provided us with the beginnings of the scaffold that we would build to create the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when we look at this chapter, and we look at on page XXVII, And it says, we believe, so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcoholic and chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of allergy. And what he means by chronic alcoholics is hopeless alcoholics. We use those interchangeably. And he says that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class, never occurs in the average temperate drinker. So, for those of us young people, that was something I really struggled with. Because I didn't drink until I, you know, had yellow eyes and cirrhosis of the liver, so maybe I'm not a real alcoholic. There was a time when we were kicking people out of Alcoholics Anonymous for not being real alcoholics, right? You know? And it was like, I remember calling up my sponsor at the time, and I'm like, Dave, what if I'm not a real alcoholic? He just laughed at me. He's like, you're a real alcoholic, click. He's like, you're not getting away with not writing that inventory. Click. But it never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Never. So whether or not it happened once, or 57 times, or 157 times, or 5,000 times, if you have allergy, you are an alcoholic. Done deal. Never occurs in the average temperate drinker. You may be a potential alcoholic, your obsession may not be to a certain point, but craving never happens in the average temperate drinker. And that's something I run into a lot in sponsorship, because I run into a lot of young people who have drank alcoholically but have been doing outside issues for a period of time. And then they come to me and they say, well, Carrie, I'm not an alcoholic, I'm an addict. And then I bring them to this state, and I bring them through doctor's opinion, and they go, damn it, I'm an alcoholic too. And I said, yeah. Because we all think that being an alcoholic means having a basketball for a liver. No. Bill boils it down to 3 points. Craving, mental obsession, spiritual malady. All that other stuff is window dressing. That's how it shows up for you. So each one of us, it shows up differently. But we look for our common points. Craving, mental obsession, spiritual malady. So the doctor's opinion goes into greater detail about it. And there's one last thing I want to hit. And it's the very bottom of the page. And it says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that, although we admit it is injurious, we can't every time differentiate the truth from the false. How many times have we brought to someone's attention, or someone bring to our attention, that maybe we're not seeing the truth about a situation, and we get irate? How dare you? I remember I was talking to a woman, and this was early on in my spiritual, you know, in my spiritual path. And I had, you know, I was on fire with the big book. And she had about 30 days. And I remember, like, she was telling me about how she was working the steps. And then she was like, well, I read the 12 and 12 back to back, and that's where the directions are. And I'm going, oh God. You know, and I said to her something about, you know, I said, well, you know, we can't differentiate the truth from the false. So you reading the 12 and 12 by yourself means that you're reading it with a really sick person. Didn't work out very well, because she got very upset with that. I probably could have said it very much nicer, but I mean, that's really kind of what we think about it. It's like, I can't differentiate the truth from the false. That my alcoholic mind cannot fix my alcoholic mind. You know, I can twist any kind of thing up in here in order to justify my actions and behaviors. I need that light of God, and I need that humility of sharing with another human being. It says that I can't enter, it says to me, my alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. I am irritable, restless, and discontent, till I can at once experience ease and comfort which comes from taking a few drinks. Drinks which I see other people taking with impunity. You want to know if you have alcoholic thinking? Are you an alcohol watcher? Because think about this. You know, we're told people, places, and things, you know. You know, the people, places, and things, fine, whatever. Like, early recovery, you gotta do that, that's what you gotta do. Okay? But the idea is this, is that if you're in, say, TGI Fridays, and you're having your dinner, and someone's, I don't know, drinking next to you, and you find your eye attracted to that glass, and you keep going back to it, and you're watching them going, look at that bead of sweat. You have an alcoholic mind. We watch other people drinking with impunity. meaning that I'm like the little kid pressed up with my nose against the glass going, can I have some please too? You know, so it's not just about the idea or the obsession of putting alcohol in my body. It's that if it was sitting right here, if this glass right here was full of alcohol, would I feel that pull? If I feel that pull, I still have the alcoholic mind. It doesn't mean you're going to drink tomorrow. It just means there's more stuff I got to do. Maybe there's some rocks I need to pull up. Maybe there are some things I need to look at. You know, because this tells me that I'm irritable, restless, and discontent. And that just the mere presence of alcohol in your hand has power over me. And that tells me, and it says, drinks which I see others taking with impunity. After I succumb to the desire again, as so many do, the phenomenon of the craving develops, and I pass through the well-known stages of spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over again until I can experience an entire psychic change as a little hope for my recovery. So if I feel that, if I have that moment, what's going on? What's blocking me from that power? Where have I gotten off the beam? Where am I asleep, dreaming, and I'm awake? It's not a judgment, guys. We have it all the time. You know, you got to test it to know you got it. So sometimes when it shows up, it's a, okay, there's something I got to look at. Doesn't mean we're bad or not, you know, not good AAs. It just means I got something going on. I got another thing I got to bring to God. And there's nothing wrong with that. We're not going to be paragons of spirituality and virtue every moment of every day. That's not what this is about. This is about living on a spiritual basis and not drinking one day at a time. So if you have that moment, if you have that thing, it's okay. Let's get to work on it. But if I have that, and I'm watching people drink with impunity, and it's got that pull, that little thing, and I got that little bit of drool in my mouth, I still have an alcoholic mind. So let's get to letting God remove that from me. So when we're talking about this first step and saying that it's not just about putting alcohol in my body, but it's about that pull, that feeling, that gravity that alcohol has, this is what we're talking about. So when it says I'm powerless, it means I'm powerless not just when I pick up that glass, but I'm powerless long before my hand even gets anywhere near it. Because I've been blocked off from the power which protects me from that glass. So when we come back to this craving, and we say that we have this craving, I have this body that metabolizes alcohol differently, that I respond differently to it, that it only happens with people like me. This is my entrance to the club. This is where I get to say, I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I am an alcoholic. And I know that's very controversial because our third tradition says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. It used to say an honest desire to stop drinking. And what I mean by this, when I say that recognizing that I have craving, recognizing that I have the alcoholic mind, and recognizing I have a spiritual malady is my entrance to the club, I don't mean to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean to the application of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I started this, I differentiated and said there's two, Alcoholics Anonymous, there's two different AAs, if you want to think about it. Go put it this way. The fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, y'all can come here all you want, whether you've got craving or not. By all means, drink our coffee, eat our donuts, eat our cookies. The first step that I'm talking about in the plan of recovery that we're discussing this weekend begins and builds on the idea that I have a craving, that I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. And it goes on to say that I have an abnormal way of thinking about alcohol. That's what it tells me. It says I can't differentiate the true from the false. Meaning I tell myself a lot of things about my drinking. We do it all the time. We explain our drinking away to ourselves all the time. You know why? Because I don't understand why I just did what I did. And that's the truth of it. And if I say that out loud, then I sound like a crazy person. So I have to be, well, if you had my life, you'd drink like me. Well, I was frustrated and pissed off. That's why I got drunk and drove that car into a tree. Now I'm even more frustrated and pissed off. Doesn't make any sense. Of course it doesn't. But I have to tell myself something to explain myself to myself. I begin to spin these stories, and after a while, I believe them. And so what happens is I begin to build this world that is created in Carrie's image rather than in God's. And all of a sudden, I am now the creator of my own universe based on the lies that I tell myself to justify the things that I do. Now, we do it with alcohol, but I do it in my relationships. I do it. You ever yell at somebody and say they deserved it? They needed that talking to. No. I was being an intolerant jerk and didn't want to take the time to talk to them. And I pretended that my yelling at you, telling you the truth about yourself, was me doing you a favor. No.